For the week of February 24th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 183, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Michael, you almost got me into a lot of trouble this past week.
What?
There I was, going to the Geffen Playhouse, okay? And you remember back when we had David Wilde on after the Grammys? I think it was episode 178 or 180.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, do you remember this moment after I was telling all of my wonderful jokes and you said I could write for the Grammys? Well, let me just play the exchange. You know, there's a reason I don't work for Leno, Letterman, or Kimmel. You know that, right?
Oh, you could write for Kimmel. Trust me.
Oh, yes.
Oh, snap. I took down Jimmy Kimmel.
Okay, so do you remember that moment?
I do.
Okay, well, so there I am at the Geffen Playhouse. I'm there to see The Gift, which is a play by Joanne Murray Smith, and it stars Kathy Baker and James Vanderbeek, among, you know, there's two other people whose names would not necessarily be recognizable. And I'm waiting to go in. It's nearly 8 o'clock, and who should be standing behind me, glaring at me?
Glaring?
Glaring. And I'm thinking, oh no, he heard. Jimmy Kimmel.
Glaring. I don't think so.
And I wanted to say, look, I'm the good one. I'm not Michael Giltz.
I'd like to think Jimmy was listening to this podcast.
But I was like, please don't say anything. Please don't say anything.
He's in number three, by the way. I've been finally getting some daily ratings of the overnight late night talk shows, thanks to Programming Insider, our friend.
That's right.
Very good website. And they now give us nightly breakdowns. Letterman and Leno have been trading back and forth night to night, depending on the lead-in or who their guests are. Letterman's been actually winning quite a few. It looks like Jimmy Kimmel was taking away a bit from Leno, competing with his audience. But what would be happening was Letterman would be number one, or Leno, then the other guy would be number two, then would be Jimmy Kimmel number three. So, you know, the ABC went from first to third, but they're a lot more competitive in the younger demo, and that's all they care about. Nightline following Jimmy Kimmel, of course, is like way down third, fourth place. So they've swapped first for third, but they're getting a little more younger demo, and therefore they're probably happy. But to me, it seems like the wrong choice.
Well, he was actually there to see Nothing to Hide, which is a magic show with these two young magicians, Derek Delgado and Helder. I can't pronounce his last name. It's Portuguese. But
have you seen it?
I did. I saw it on New Year's Eve, and it's very, very good. They're very
right.
Good.
Well, good to know he has good taste in magic. Maybe they'll be on his show.
I think that's probably why he was there. Yes.
And who will be on our show?
Ann Thompson from IndieWire's Thompson on Hollywood blog. Of course, she also hosts this little podcast called Oscar Talk. And can you imagine why we would have her on the day after the Academy Awards?
Yes, I can.
Okay, yeah, because we really want to talk about, and we should thank the Academy for creating really the probably the best organic homeopathic sleep aid.
All right.
Okay, so my jokes still aren't that good. Are they better than Seth MacFarlane's, though, from last night's show?
You could write for the Oscars.
Well, last night's show was on television, and in television news, Nielsen is finally getting with the program and is going to include streaming television views in their ratings, finally. Even so, it may be a little too late for some of this season's new hour-long dramas, even though I watched some of them and they probably won't go anywhere. In any case, Billboard is also changing the way it tabulates its music charts by incorporating YouTube views, we'll explain. We'll end with some inside baseball about Spotify, the streaming music service, as well as some listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right, we have box office figures for movies around the world, but this week's numbers have a big asterisk next to them, and we'll explain after we're done. The number one movie around the world, as far as we know, is A Good Day to Die Hard, which grossed $45 million. It's at $185 million and counting. It's doing much better overseas than in North America. At number two around the world, jumping back up the charts, is The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, which I thought would win the Oscar for Best Makeup. It didn't, but it did win $19 million in China, where it just opened up. And that means it's now at $980 million. So the movie, which looked like it had lost steam, is definitely going to enter the $1 billion club.
Well, I think that the Academy has something against yak hair. I think that's why it didn't win.
Well, it won a lot of awards last time out. As I made my picks, I thought, you know what? There's so little love for this movie as an artistic, you know, success, that I was thinking to you, maybe it will be Les Mis or something else, and I should have gone with my gut, but I didn't. Number three around the world is Identity Theft, starring Melissa McCarthy, who was also on the Oscars. It grossed another $15 million, including just a little bit around the world. It's opened up just a tad overseas. It's at $94 million and counting. At number four is Snitch, the Dwayne The Rock Johnson film. That grossed $13 million, but it's a little better than his last movie or two, and Lionsgate only paid $5 million for North American rights, so it's already practically tripled the amount they paid for it. Obviously, that's one of those deals, I assume, where the people who sold the movie gave it to Lionsgate with a commitment for a big ad campaign, knowing that if it opened up decently in North America, that would make it far more valuable when they opened it overseas.
That's true.
Sort of a loss leader idea.
Well, and there's also when you sell to television, you get certain bumps if you have a domestic box office of a certain level.
You gotta have a release, obviously.
Right.
Yeah, and we know that. But I'm thinking it's sort of a loss leader. Hey, open it in North America, give it to them cheap so they'll pump money into it and get a certain number when it opens. And then you know you're going to get more in Asia and Africa and all that. At number five around the world is Escape from Planet Earth, the animated film with the voice of William Shatner, among many others, had quite a good hold. It grossed $11 million and it's at $35 million and counting. At number six, we have three movies tied at $10 million each. It's kind of a great breakdown. Safe Haven grossed almost all its money in North America. That's the romantic drama based on the Nicholas Sparks novel. Silver Linings Playbook has been opening up overseas. That grossed about half its money in North America as it, you know, had success at the Oscars, winning Best Actress, and half overseas. And Les Miserables won almost all its money overseas. So all three made $10 million. Safe Haven is at $48 million. Silver Linings Playbook is at $160 million. And Les Miserables is just about to hit $400 million, I should say.
That's got to be a disappointment for Universal and the filmmakers behind Les Mis. I mean, this is a...
Are you kidding me? That's one of the highest grossing musicals of all time, unadjusted for inflation. It cost $85 million to make, and it's grossed $400 million worldwide. It's a critical and commercial success story.
Okay, then never mind. I didn't realize it only cost $85 million to make. I thought it cost way more than that. And I guess I assumed that since this is a musical that played in almost every country in the world for decades, that the producers would have expected it to rake in money faster and at a higher level than it has.
Well, it's a very popular musical, but it's a sung through musical that's very unusual for a film, and that just makes it harder to the numbers has the budget of $61 million. You can bet Hugh Jackman has a piece of that puzzle. So how much they need to make in order for it to earn money, I'm not quite sure. But their stated budget is $61 million. We got to take their word on that. I'm sure Hugh Jackman has some serious deal, and he's certainly hit those numbers. So he's definitely made his $20, $30, $40 million because they've certainly hit some certain target levels. But if you look at the musicals in the last 10, 20 years, this is as good as you could get. So there's nothing, you can't expect to make $500 million, $1 billion on a musical. It just doesn't happen.
I take it back then.
Unless you're animated. Okay. Animated musicals, of course, make a ton of money. You're right. It's a wildly popular stage musical. That's why it's returning to Broadway. More on that later. And of course, it's pre-sold. So you have that, you know, that's why it's doing better than almost any other musical in the last 20 years. At number nine is Django Unchained, the Quentin Tarantino film, $9 million worldwide, $380 million and counting. Another success story because it cost about $100 million to make. At number 10, two movies tied at $8 million each, Wreck-It Ralph, which lost out on Best Animated Feature to Brave, and Dark Skies, a horror flick starring Kerry Russell and Josh Hamilton. Wreck-It Ralph's at $428 million and counting worldwide. It's just about done. And Dark Skies, I guess Kerry Russell can say, well, at least her TV show, The Americans, got picked up for a second season.
Thank goodness. I love that show.
Well, good. Otherwise, the movie, not so hot. At number 11 is another low-budget horror film, Mama, starring Jessica Chastain. But that's sort of a good success story. It's grossed $7 million, and it's at $97 million and counting. At number 12, three movies tied at $6 million each. Warm Bodies, the Nicholas Holt zombie romantic comedy. Lincoln, starring Daniel Day-Lewis, Oscar winner for the third time. And Hansel and Gretel, Witch Hunters. Rich Hunters? Witch Hunters. Hansel and Gretel, Witch Hunters. That's at $163 million. And again, a low-budget movie, relatively speaking. I doubt Jeremy Renner has a lot of points. Therefore, that's a success story. Lincoln, $245 million worldwide. And Warm Bodies is at $77 million. And it may be worth even more on DVD once Nicholas Holt's new movie opens up this weekend. That's Jack the Giant Slayer, which now he's been good key supporting roles, a hit TV series. Now he has this modestly successful film, pretty successful film, Warm Bodies. And now he's launching what could be a franchise, or certainly a very big budget, you know, tentpole type movie. So it's a big, big week for Nicholas Holt.
We should say what TV show Nicholas Holt is in.
Well, he's not in it anymore. He was in Skins.
Right, exactly. I had no idea. That's why I was having you do that instead of myself.
Okay. Well, anyway, we mentioned that this list has a big asterisk next to it. You know why that is? Well, that's because we have a correction for last week's box office chart. Last week, we said the number one movie around the world was the Die Hard franchise flick, A Good Day to Die Hard, which last week grossed $86 million worldwide. We said that was the number one movie, and we were wrong. There was
what?
A movie that was bigger, that grossed more money, that we knew nothing about. The number one movie around the world last weekend was, in fact, the Chinese language film Journey to the West, which grossed $94 million. It was Chinese New Year. And that movie that weekend grossed $94 million. It looks set to pass the blockbuster hit Lost in Thailand as the highest grossing Chinese film of all time. And it might challenge Avatar down the road if it keeps going at this length.
Well, you mean it will challenge Avatar in China?
In China for
right.
the top grossing film
worldwide.
Of all time in China.
Right.
Right. It's already at $113 million, I think. So this is a huge blockbuster film. It was directed by Stephen Chow, who people might know. He directed Kung Fu Hustle and CJ7, some movies that had good releases in North America. He's an actor-director. I don't think he acts in this film, but it's Journey to the West. It's not a prequel, but an origin story about the monk and the Monkey King, who are the main characters in Journey to the West. This is an iconic tale in China. It's sort of like Robin Hood in England. Everybody knows this story. It's been told and retold in countless movies, TV shows, miniseries, mangas, comic books, you name it. And it's one of the most famous stories in all of Asia, certainly. Everybody knows it. And yet, I don't know why, but it's never been translated into English in anything other than a really bad academic version. So I've never read it, unfortunately. I bought one version. It was so awful you couldn't read it. I'm still waiting for someone to translate this tale into English. But anyway, it's a huge story, turned into a movie, massive hit over Chinese New Year's, but we didn't know about it.
Well, you know, maybe we can hire Christoph Waltz to kind of tell us his version of the story, like he did with the story of Broomhilda in Django Unchained.
I don't know that he speaks Cantonese or Mandarin.
Okay.
But, you know, we could give him a call. So this is a big hit film. It'll, I imagine, be picked up for North America by somebody. Unfortunately, it's in 3D, so you can't, you know, you can't have everything. But, you know, this is the origin story. So it's not strictly the Journey to the West, which is the story of how the monk and his companions all travel to India on a pilgrimage. It's sort of an action tale. It is comedy. It's very philosophical. It's just a tale that works on many levels. There are a lot of kids' books, picture book versions of this story. It's just an iconic tale. I'd love to read a good version of it, but it just doesn't exist. How much it grossed this weekend? We have no idea. Nobody mentioned it. Hollywood Reporter had a big story like 4 or 5 days after the box office saying, oh, by the way, this movie grossed $94 million. And so this week when they did their foreign box office, I said, well, what did Journey to the West do? You know, last week it grossed $94 million, but we don't know. So our information is only as good as what we get. And, you know, we pass it along when we get it. But sometimes if people don't cover it, a big hit in Bollywood or Korea or China, we're in the dark.
Yeah, I mean, and there's very, I mean, RentTrak does a good job of covering most of the world, but when it comes to some of these
They cover the Hollywood movies in other countries. So it's a natural bias, just like a lot of our stories are based on, you know, North American bias. We don't cover the British awards as much or television in France or Japan. We try to when we can, but naturally that's our bias. So those people cover Hollywood movies and how they do overseas. They don't always cover the local big hits unless they're being picked up or distributed by a Hollywood studio.
You know, they basically work with exhibitors. So that's a whole other, you know, we're not going to get into that now. You know why?
Why?
Because we should probably, since I know we're going to run long today, give Ann Thompson a call. What do you think?
All right. Well, let's just jump right into the Oscars and get into how boring the show was. We're going to get Ann Thompson on the phone, and Sperling is calling her right now.
Well, Ann Thompson, of course, from the Thompson on Hollywood blog over at IndieWire. Of course, she also hosts Oscar Talk with Chris Tapley. Ann, thank you for taking the time to join us.
I'm happy to do so.
It's Christmas, New Year's, and your birthday all rolled up into one.
Well, let's just say I'm a little tired this morning, but I'm in a good mood, mainly because, you know, we could talk about the show or whatever, but when you actually come out at the top of the Gold Derby Oscar pool, that puts you in a really good mood.
19 out of 24 picks, including Brave, was a really good choice of yours. 19 out of 24, right? You trounced me, certainly. I only got 15 right, but you trounced everybody else too. Congratulations.
Well, there were two other people in there with me, but it felt good. Doing that Oscar Talk podcast with Chris Tapley every week really keeps me on my toes, because he's a fierce, fierce, knowledgeable guy. And, you know, I better watch my shorts. I better watch my docs. I better be on the case every week. So, you know, I think it sort of sharpened my mettle a little bit.
That's funny, because my advice to people is the best way, I think, to pick a ballot is to not watch anything. Because then you don't get confused about what you actually like and what you hate and your personal biases of the actual films involved. I think it might be easier if you don't see any of them.
I disagree with that and completely. But for example, if you look at the Nate Silver thing, you know, he says, okay, I'm so good at playing with stats, I'm going to get into Oscar predicting. And he does this extremely crude version of what we all do, which is to look at what all the other winners are and how predictive groups like the DGA and BAFTA can be. And he gets a lot wrong because he's not playing the more sophisticated, subtle, you know, inside the beltway, kind of listening to Academy members, recognizing what it is they like and don't like, feeling the momentum of the race as it moves along, which is what you're doing if you're really paying attention, I argue. And the trick, but you're right, the real trick is not to let last minute campaigning momentum and surging, you know, perceptions of things changing or what you want to have happen, you know, affect you. And if you can pull back and really stick to what you think will win, you're better off.
Well, we should mention that Nate Silver is a blogger, a political blogger. He runs the 538 blog over at the New York Times. And he correctly predicted the political election now, I guess, in two presidential elections.
50 states.
And I guess he, you know, there was one race out of all the races this year that he, or last year that he missed. He's also the author of The Signal and the Noise. And he
only tried to pick the top six, so he didn't really play the full Oscar ballot. And he said he didn't do a good job. So he's certainly not touting himself as an expert in this area. He did it for fun and said, look, I'm not doing very well.
Yeah, he actually.
But what you're saying is just going with the stats. That's what I'm arguing is that's not going to do it.
No, yeah. I'm not talking about going with the stats. I'm just talking about don't watch the movies.
That's what I mean. You have to watch. In other words, the story that Lincoln was the early lead, you know, and why that would be and why people would perceive Lincoln as the front runner, there are reasons why that's true. You have to see the movie to understand why Lincoln, you know, was so good or should have done so well. And then to see Argo, you know, completely trump it at the end of the day. That's a fascinating story. And you still have to, I think you have to see the films and see how they play to really understand how that could have happened.
I'd like to follow up on that for just a second, because last week, Michael, you might remember that I said there were a couple of executives that I spoke to, one of whom works at DreamWorks, and was saying, look, there's no way we're winning with Lincoln. And when I asked him why, he said, you know what? It's all about the story. This is a year where you need a story to win. And it's not the story of the film, but the story behind the filmmakers, because this is kind of an inside award. This isn't, you know, picked by the public at large. And Ben Affleck had a better story. He was coming back from, you know, basically a career where he was starring in Geely and Reindeer Games, and now he's, you know, except for Best Director, he's got this wonderful film that's going to win the Best Picture, and went on to win the Best Picture. And I guess looking at that, I was surprised that Chris Terrio won for, I guess he's the screenwriter of Argo, for adapted screenplay. Granted, he did win the WGA, he won several other awards, but I thought for some reason Tony Kushner might be able to pull it out, but Lincoln couldn't even pull that out.
There was a real shift that occurred where Argo became the very, very popular underdog, and you cannot discount the power of an actor director. You know, I mean, it's happened with Clint Eastwood, Kevin Costner, Robert Redford, Warren Beatty, Mel Gibson. I mean, that factor plus the snub, the director snub, turning the movie into an underdog. But it was more than that. It was also the fact that the movie was a hugely satisfying film about American heroes. It was thrilling. When CIA agent Tony Mendez stood at the Academy premiere, the crowd went wild and cheered him. They were cheering for America. They were cheering for Hollywood. And the two combined with Affleck, It was impossible to beat. And it won everything. It won everything all through the season, one thing after another. It isn't like the year that Apollo 13 was going up against Braveheart, where if you look at all the different awards that each of those films won, they were splitting them.
Right.
They were truly competitive with each other. And it was a tough call which one would win on Oscar night.
Yeah, this year I tried to ignore the momentum for a while, but eventually I was going, no, Lincoln, they're getting confused. The Golden Globes don't matter. Eventually I just went, you know what, Argo's going to win. But how did you know that Ang Lee was going to win for Best Director?
That's where I'm trying to explain that female intuition is sometimes a strong thing, because it's not, because you couldn't, as Nate Silver pointed out, you couldn't pick the director prize based on previous wins, because Ben Affleck won the DGA but wasn't obviously nominated for the Oscar, and therefore the two people who overlapped were Ang Lee and Steven Spielberg, so it was one or the other. Life of Pi, I figured, was going to win 4 awards, including director, and Ang Lee was going to win because he's truly beloved, and he has such a range of skills in so many different genres. He's won before. Brokeback Mountain, by the way, he was robbed. You know, he won director but didn't win picture. This is the second time that's happened to him. But at any rate, I believe that there's this wise, sage, honorable man that people truly, truly like, that he was popular in a way that Spielberg, for whatever reason, is not.
Well, I can tell you this particular executive at DreamWorks said, look, he's works with him every day. He's a nice guy. But the Academy and the Academy members really, like, you know, what do they want to give him? One more thing? He's a billionaire that can get anything and gets everything that he wants. Why give him one more trophy?
I think that's probably part of the factor. By the way, though, people in Hollywood really did like Lincoln, but they were in they were at a disadvantage against someone like Affleck and Clooney, too, by the way, who was sort of helping his protege in a funny way, the producer of the movie, who knows what he's doing as well. Basically, you had a situation where Lincoln couldn't campaign effectively. You had Spielberg too big for the room. You had aloof Daniel Day-Lewis, who didn't like doing it. And you had crotchety Tommy Lee Jones. And so, you know, and in some ways I have to argue that Kushner, even though he was nominated before for Munich, he's something of an outsider. He's considered a playwright. He's considered someone from Broadway. And
because he is.
Yeah.
You know? As opposed to someone who, I think they decided to give Daniel Day-Lewis the win for Lincoln. That was it. That was going to be it.
Well, you know, it's funny, when that award was given, it was given by Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson? Yeah, Mel Gibson gave it. No, Meryl Streep. I don't know where that came from. Mel Gibson.
You are out of your mind.
Meryl Streep gave the award. And all evening, it seemed like people were having difficulty opening the envelopes. Towards the end, I think that the stage manager was probably kind of, you know, unsealing them just a tad to make it a little bit easier, because it got a little bit easier throughout the evening.
But they were trying to save time also.
Exactly.
At the very end.
And so they cut back to Meryl Streep after the nominees were announced. And she just says, and the award goes to Daniel Day-Lewis. She doesn't even hold up the envelope.
I don't know if she even read it. Why bother?
She did it. She actually cut. They told her, get that thing open before that you finish with the things. So that's what they did.
That
they
makes sense.
They had to have. I'm not saying I know that, but that's what they had to have decided to do.
One of your other big picks as an upset victory over what everyone was predicting was for Best Animated Feature, where you stuck with Brave, whereas most people picked Wreck-It Ralph. What was your thinking on that one?
I went back and forth on that. I started with Brave, went to Wreck-It Ralph, and came back to Brave. And that was after it had started winning some things. And I realized that even though Wreck-It Ralph had won the Annies, that a lot of the tech awards had gone to Brave. And something had turned in that campaign where Brenda Chapman and Mark Andrews were campaigning together as friendly entities. They accepted the BAFTA as friendly entities, even though there had been, you know, a situation at Pixar, which happens a lot there, by the way, where Andrews came in to take over for Chapman, who
That's
had created
right.
the movie. I believed that Brave was going to win, not only for that reason, but because it was the classier, beautiful movie, and that Wreck-It Ralph, even if we all admire it, and I do, I love Wreck-It Ralph a lot, it's the scruffier video game male kind of play, as opposed to the more Tony, Brave, I think.
Well, that's where being in Los Angeles helps a lot, because I didn't know that Brenda Chapman was campaigning with the film and all that, because I thought the only reason it wouldn't win was because of that sort of negative aura. It was
They turned it around.
Yeah, the first Pixar film with a female lead, but they had fired the female director, and I thought that was a deal killer. If I'd known she was, you know, publicly working it and they were all good friends, I really thought it was going to, you know, I wanted it to be Wreck-It Ralph because I didn't even like that movie. So I was glad it won. And if you'd known that, that really helps judge what's going on there.
I do think being in LA is an advantage. I do.
Well, can we talk about the campaigning for a second? Because you say Daniel Day-Lewis did not want to campaign. This is the most he's ever campaigned.
They got him to do a lot, but I mean, a lot more than he ever would have done on his own, or, you know, they pushed him to do some key things, but he showed up where he had to show up. He went to do the, Santa Barbara Film Festival tribute, but, you know, these were calculated things. It wasn't like he was working the room every 5 minutes the way Ben Affleck was.
Right. And I guess, by the way, did you like his speech? It seems like it was pre-written. And
he understands, and everybody has obviously enlightened him. He recognizes what his image is, and realizes the risk that he runs of seeming incredibly serious and almost crazy. So he's very self-deprecatingly and humorously making fun of himself in a way that I found really charming, and I guess you did too.
Yeah, well, and you know, he kind of brought Meryl Streep into it as well. I thought that was
hilarious.
Yeah, and he knew Meryl Streep was going to be giving the award, so that could have been written beforehand. Somebody else who campaigned a bit was Robert De Niro. Usually he never campaigns, and he was nominated for Silver Linings Playbook Best Supporting Actor. And that was the first award of the evening, and he did not win. And I think the winner of that race, Christoph Waltz, took many by surprise.
I agree. I did not vote for that, and I was surprised. Although one of the things Nate Silver pointed out, it was fascinating to see his chart of how often certain groups are predictive. And I didn't realize that BAFTA was as predictive as it actually is. So winning BAFTA is something to take seriously now, more than I ever. I mean, there is an overlap of about 300 people in the Academy, the British contingent. You can't ever ignore it, but it's worth paying attention to, even though SAG is more predictive than BAFTA, which is why Tommy Lee Jones was considered the front runner.
Well, let's talk about the show itself now. What's your verdict for the show overall?
And we should say 40 million people watched it last night, and it's up 19% over last year in the key demographics.
The reason for that would be that there were so many popular movies. This is probably the most popular group of films in contention, you know, since 1939. Richard Corliss in Time magazine suggested this, and I agree with him. And I think that that's what accounts for it. And most of the time, if it's a Titanic year or a Lord of the Rings year, that's when the ratings are up. It has nothing to do with Seth MacFarlane. I hope they never bring him back. I think he's a misogynist, crude pig. Honestly, I don't like him. But he was the best word you could use for him is serviceable.
So Anne, but don't hold back. What did you really think of Seth MacFarlane?
I know what
the musical stuff. You see, I think that you know, the two producers, Zayden and Maron, you know, they put together this amazingly entertaining musical show. And I have to say, I sat in the house. I was in the theater last night.
Oh, so you weren't backstage. You weren't
in several years. I had gone in the past, but not for several years. I loved all of that stuff. I loved Shirley Bassey. I loved. I wished Adele could have come right after Shirley Bassey. That would have been really cool. In the Bond tribute mm-hmm. section. But I loved the Les Mis thing. That played incredibly well inside the house, really well. And I loved, the only one I would have let go, but they had to do all the songs, was Norah Jones doing Suddenly. And the closing number was a disaster for everyone. I didn't hear one person who liked the closing number.
Ugh, it was horrible. They, instead of just ending with Best Picture, they'd cut back to Seth MacFarlane and Ellen Chenoweth singing a song to the losers. I thought that and the whole song about I Saw Your Boobs, I thought that was horrible and in horrible taste.
Well, they were trying to deflect that with the William Shatner thing, which actually was sort of amusing, except that it went on too long. And I spoke to Shatner afterwards, and he was sitting in a room with a earbud, you know, and they were filming him on a little set, you know. The whole thing was live. It was great in a way. And it was a clever way to get rid of the whole issue of him being tasteless, which they had to contend with. There's nothing you could do with it. He is tasteless.
But I can tell you that sitting at home, it was that first 17 minutes or half an hour with him was, in my opinion, just awful. I mean, it was cringeworthy. And I
have to watch it on my television set and see how it plays, because I thought he was flat. I thought he was really kind. I didn't like him at all as a host, but I have to see how it plays on TV.
Well, then you went into after his 17 minutes, you went into Paul Rudd and Melissa McCarthy and their dreadful banter, which set the tone for horrible writing the entire night.
I agree with that. I think the biggest problem with McFarlane, they thought they were getting a multi-hyphenate. They thought they were getting, and he brought in his own writing team. Terrible job on the writing.
Oh, it was so terrible. Bad. I mean,
most of it was flat. Most of it wasn't funny. Most of it was not playing in the room or out of it, as far as I could tell.
No, and I thought the funniest joke was when he said, this next presenter needs no introduction. And he walks off stage and it's Meryl Streep. I thought, well,
was good.
That was actually good.
But that whole thing with the Sound of Music didn't work.
No.
And the whole the thing with there was one cocaine joke that I chuckled at sort of slightly.
Yeah. Which, it's kind of like, wait a second. 40 million people are watching. You're basically saying that Hollywood's the drug capital. Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, to me, it wasn't even his banter as much as the banter of the presenters, which I hated. It's such a time waster. If you look at the Grammys, they get them on there and they present the award. The Oscars, they have them still doing this lame routine. The Avengers guys come out, you're short, you're angry, you're whatever. The other people
bad.
Come
that was
people
bad.
Come out from Chicago, and it's just a time waster. And
but
you're looking
Catherine
at your
Zeta-Jones was great.
She was lip syncing.
Jennifer Hudson was great. I loved all that stuff.
Jennifer Hudson really kind of brought it, but Catherine Zeta-Jones was lip syncing. And who performed right after after Jennifer Hudson?
Well, Barbara Streisand was good, I thought.
Well, I love that because it's Barbara Streisand. So we do the in memoriam, but she's like, you're not going to have them showing photos while I'm singing. So you're going to have the camera on me. So we did the whole in memoriam, and then she came out and then did the in memoriam song. So it was like twice as long as it normally would be.
But yeah. I actually like that. They said they were aiming for 3.5 hours. And the only reason it went over by 5 minutes was because of the tie.
Ah, that's true. There was a tie, and I guess it was for sound editing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the show ran over half an hour, didn't it?
They aimed for 3.5. They knew it was going to be long.
You have nine nominees. So, yeah, wow. I mean, well, let me ask you this. I didn't realize you were sitting in the auditorium, which it is a different show from sitting in the auditorium. This is the first year that I've noticed two things. One, I was listening on a 5.1 surround sound. You know, I could hear people whispering in the rear speakers. But I actually heard the photographers shooting the acceptance speeches as well as the presentations. I almost never have heard that. Also, I also saw halfway through, and it's always been known that they kind of give out snacks to the people in the audience, but we actually saw it this year.
The cigarette girls going around with the little snacks.
Yeah,
yes.
We got popcorn and we got, you know, that, and they were handing out Reese's peanut butter cups. And this was in, it was sort of in the second half.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's so long, especially for the people that aren't walking the red carpet per se, that where they just kind of walk into the venue. They're there at like, you know, 3 in the afternoon. Yeah, they're there very early. And so they're there for like an hour or two before the show even starts.
Well, they lure you. They try to get you to go really early. We didn't go that early. But it's really fun to walk the red carpet. It, you know, you're part. But they were telling us not to shoot pictures, which made me crazy, which is absurd since everybody and their mother is shooting pictures there. And then I tried to take a picture of the actual CEO of the Academy, Dawn Hudson, and like somebody like pulled her away from me, you know. It was like hysterical. I was being my usual rebel self, taking pictures of everybody I could. I got Adele, I got Jessica Chastain. I was having fun.
And what were you wearing?
I decided I was not going to squeeze myself into my Spanx this year, and wore a black suit.
Nice.
And I was comfortable and happy.
Now, Michael, you see, this, it just goes to show you, you are not a red carpet reporter or a fashion reporter, because everybody knows you don't ask what are you wearing, you ask who are you wearing.
I couldn't even tell you. But it's my version of a tuxedo, and I rely on it, you know. I can put my iPhone in my pocket like a man.
Well, it was the year in music. That was the theme of the show. I did like the James Bond tribute because they let Shirley Bassey sing her entire song. They didn't make her do a truncated 90-second version of it. I thought
she
that
rocked
was
it in the house. When she hit that last note, they gave her a standing O.
Absolutely. It was one of the highlights of the show. However, they didn't play all the best Oscar song nominees. They skipped two of them. They played excerpts on tape from Life of Pi and Scarlett Johansson's song for the documentary film Chasing Ice.
That's
which
true. So they could have cut Nora Jones. They should have. I don't see why she... It's such a silly, stupid song, the Ted song. And why was she singing it? I didn't understand that at all.
I couldn't tell strange. You. But actually, the third in that little troika there was Les Mis.
Right. Well, that was sort of the history of movie musicals, which stretched all the way back 10 or so years to Chicago. It's like they're doing the history of, you know, those guys' movie musicals. Anyway.
Well, you know, actually, when you're listening to it at home, and I was listening to it, you know, again, through a pretty, I don't want to say high end, but it was, you know, I actually
sounds had, like it.
Well, I had a 5.1 surround sound, you know, set up.
Okay, okay.
That you know, anybody could really set up. But it's calibrated and everything. And you could actually hear Russell Crowe on that last note. You could hear he hit that one last note flat. And the Shirley Bassey was mixed horribly.
Well, that's why I need to see it again. Because when you're listening to something like that in the house, the sound is really strange, you know. So I want to see how it played. I mean, also the whole idea that they had the entire orchestra in the Capitol building, you know.
Strange. I wonder why that was.
That was so weird.
The Capitol Records is about half a mile away.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
what's the advantage of that? Did they need the space?
Yes.
Apparently they needed the space, the our orchestra pit there at the Dolby for all of its state of the art, whatever it is, theater, couldn't accommodate as many as they wanted or given. I also think, honestly, if you look at what they did actually pull off in terms of a production, that was an enormous show. I mean, I was aware of how they were moving the sets around and what they were moving in and moving off and how many people were on the stage and stuff like that. It was a huge production. So it went off pretty well.
You know, though, as I was watching and I thought to myself, how do you make this show where you give out 24 awards, how do you make it less boring? I don't think you can because it's one award after another.
You cut out all the banter. You cut out the extraneous stuff. If you didn't have him doing 20 minutes, 25 minutes of stand-up, you've cut half an hour from the show right there. If the people aren't saying stupid introductory jokes, you cut out 10 or 15 minutes there. And they had actors like handing out two or three awards at the same time. You had the Avengers people handing out the special effects and the other one.
That was,
you
know, smart. That was smart. Yeah. They did that a lot. They had the two writing awards at the same time and so forth. But I mean, I think that there's something about the Oscars that I prefer frankly, I prefer the montage at the beginning, which is always fun. I prefer a host who actually engages with the crowd as an insider. I think that's the important thing. And this guy, McFarlane, is, they thought they were getting a writer, dancer, singer. They thought they were, you know, getting someone who could do what they wanted him to do in terms of the kind of show they wanted to put on. But what he isn't is a personality that we can recognize and have a relationship with. And I think that's a real problem. And to the extent that he actually has a personality, it's sort of a negative one. He's a snark. He's a nasty guy.
I know what joke I bet set you off, because it set me off too. It was a joke about Zero Dark Thirty, where he felt the need to make fun of every single Best Picture nominee. And when they introduced Zero Dark Thirty, he then said, it just reminds us that every woman just won't let anything go. You're like,
he
really?
He got a laugh for that, which was unfortunate. But the real low point for me was his reference to Rex Reed and Adele. I wanted to kill him.
Oh, yeah, that was a very...
Adele is a fabulous, 100% wonderful person, and I don't want anyone mentioning her weight. Thank you very much.
That was actually a very kind of inside the Beltway joke.
I know.
And yeah.
But I didn't like it.
And speaking of inside the Beltway, you mentioned visual effects, Michael, and that they had the same people give that out. That was the five people or four people.
Five from the people. Avengers. They killed at Comic-Con, but they didn't do so great at the Oscars.
No, I mean, but also there was this whole thing going on about Rhythm and Hues. And this is a company that did the effects for Life of Pi and then has to file for bankruptcy because of the way visual effects is done today, where you have Disney now owning ILM, and basically all these studios own their own effects houses.
Sony owns Imageworks. And then the other ones are left bidding for jobs as if they were, you know, carpenter contractors, you know. And it's a terrible, terrible system because there's so many of them competing and against the big ones. The big ones are safe, and then the little ones are competing. And they keep having to underbid for what they're going to, just to get the job. And then they overspend in order to complete the job. And each time they get farther and farther into the red. And it's just a terrible, terrible system that needs to be reformed. And there was a big protest at the Oscars.
That's what I was going to go into, was there was the visual effects union was protesting outside. It was referenced by the Avenger cast there. I thought they did a horrible job of trying to reference it. They tried to make a joke out of it, and it fell flat, and it seemed like they were making mistakes.
I didn't even understand what they were saying, so you picked up on that better than I did.
The winner of the visual effects got played off the stage as they tried to give a shout-out to the company.
Although I thought that the Jaws theme was a funny way to do that, by the way. Yeah.
Essentially, the issue is that these companies are essential for Hollywood because Hollywood depends on crunch time. They're going to need a lot of different companies to step in and start doing the visual effects so they can meet their deadline. So they have their in-house people, and then when they need them, they go to these freelancers and get them to do cut-rate work at a cut-rate price at the last minute, and those companies want to do the best possible work, and they bid to do the job, and they get screwed over in every possible way because they're last-minute add-ins. They have to get a low rate because they're just sort of bidding for the scraps, but they're essential for Hollywood to do its work.
They are, and they're absolutely at the center of what drives most of the big movies now, especially in this tentpole universe that we exist in today.
What I thought was interesting was that in a recent newspaper article, I think it was in the New York Times, they talked about how Rhythm and Hues, the people from Life of Pi worked for Rhythm and Hues, won the award for best visual effects, and were on stage. That two studios came in after the company filed for Chapter 11 and said, oh, we'll pay the bills for Rhythm and Hues for the next two to three months, mainly because those studios have films with Rhythm and Hues that they need that company to finish. And I thought to myself, well, wait a second. If this were working properly, you'd be doing that anyway by paying a going rate.
Exactly.
But the studios can afford to pay for this work in a way that they're not stepping up. And I think that's part of the problem.
But I can tell you from working with the studios, and I don't want to bash the studios too much here, but
why not?
Well, because I work with them. And I can tell you that they are fierce when it comes to lowering costs. And in more than one occasion that I've been personally involved with, they have forced the costs down to such a degree that there's no way for these companies to stay in business. Or should I ask the folks from Kodak?
I know. Well, we're in the middle of a big transition now, and this is part of some of the fallout that's occurring.
Yeah, I mean, the studio guys thought they could actually control the end of film, but they lowered the cost so much that even Kodak, the maker of film, could not stay in business.
Yes, but that has a lot to do with Kodak not kind of transition to digital that they needed to make.
Well, that's true, too. But yeah.
Absolutely. I think Rhythm and Hues is more an indication of the economy as a whole, where companies don't want to have employees, don't want to have people that get good salaries and benefits. They want freelancers that they can hire at the last minute and get as cheap as possible. And they don't want to invest in their employees. Even though they need these companies, they've got them over a barrel. Where else are they going to go to work to do their job with the Rhythm and Hues? They have no choice.
There's a lot of overseas competition. There's a lot of lower bidding coming from people who work in other countries. But the problem with Rhythm and Hues is that it's a cash crunch situation where if you're lining up all of the people who are working for you, whether they're employees or part-time or from overseas or whatever, and you get a cancellation of a job and suddenly all of that money that you were going to get isn't coming, you're screwed. And so they're constantly in a situation where they have to borrow against with future earnings and stuff like that. It's a bad problem.
Well, you know, watching last night the Academy Awards, which is, by the way, what we're talking about, there was two audible gasps. The first from outside the room, from all those people who had bet on Oscar pools. And it came very early when Christoph Waltz won. I don't think anybody expected it. And I think anybody that had filled out an Oscar ballot.
And Thompson expected it.
Not me. No, I didn't get that
one. Oh, no,
that's
the one you got wrong.
I started off badly.
Yeah, I think everybody just went, oh. But the other moment.
But that also forecast that Tarantino was going to win.
That's right.
Screenplay. And I knew I hadn't voted for him either. So I lost those two.
And I was kind of headed down that road to Jennifer Lawrence winning for Best Actress and then tripping literally up the steps. There had to have been a moment in the auditorium.
Yeah, there. You know what's interesting about that is that I was up in the balcony, and a lot of the POVs from the this is why I have to watch the show. A lot of the POVs on the camera weren't the same as they were in the hall. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
In other words, I didn't see her fall.
Okay.
In the auditorium, and then she referenced it when she got to the front, but I didn't see it.
Well, and what was with Tarantino's peace out? What was, I mean, and they were going to try and cut him off? Why would you ever cut Tarantino off?
I know. They were running late at that point. They were freaking out.
Because they had 40 minutes of sketch comedy.
That horrible closing number. Oh, I wish they could have figured out that they didn't need it.
The one thing that they can't control are the speeches, which I thought was another reason this year was so incredibly boring. Every speech was a litany of thank yous for the lawyer and agent. Anne, what did you think?
They were, I know, and everybody tells them not to do it. And then they, you know who gave the best speech? Ben Affleck. Thank you very much. The guy is a smart guy. He does have a story, as you say, and he milked it, as usual. And he can write. The guy can write. He knows how to tell a story. It was the best speech of the night.
Yeah,
I thought one of the worst was Anne Hathaway's, just because I thought it was so ridiculous that she ended as if she'd made a film about child soldiers in Rwanda or something. She said, let's hope that the Fantines of the world will just be. I mean, she made a movie about the French Revolution, not about, you know, some current predicament of prostitution.
She's not the best speech giver. I mean, that's been true all along.
No, people actually couldn't. I mean, even Sally Field realized, hey, they're going to give it to Anne. And I think that was a moment of, you know,
that was another tasteless, you know, clip along with the boob thing. Yeah. All of them were tasteless.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they like to thank people. And I think here they were thanking Anne Hathaway. Hey, thanks. A couple years ago, you hosted this show. Hey, thanks for doing that, since you had to do it with James Franco, who apparently was asleep the whole time. And the Oscars also like to kind of anoint people, as they did with Jennifer Lawrence winning Best Actress.
Well, the thing about Jennifer Lawrence is that she's just a winning personality, too. And it's interesting that coming out of this awards season, obviously she wins the Oscar, which puts her in a whole another category. But she's already got the franchise, Hunger Games. Now she's got the Oscar. She's a huge, huge, bankable movie star now. But you know who also comes out as a star? Kevenjanae Wallace.
That's true. You know? And she is now going to play
star in Annie.
That's right.
That's what she wrote, you know? I love
Can she sing?
She sings. And anyone who's been on the Oscar circuit knows that she also dances.
Yes.
There's all these videos everywhere of her dance. And she was dancing at the Fox party last night, too.
Well, let me ask you this, because speaking of Kevenzine Wallace, she was in Beasts of the Southern Wild. She was nominated for Best Actress. Beasts of the Southern Wild was shut out last night at the Oscars, even though it was nominated.
No, it wasn't. It was happy to be there.
Right. But the Spirit Awards, which, by the way, you also covered on Saturday, it didn't win a single thing there either.
I think it won cinematography.
Oh, absolutely right. You're right. I apologize.
So it deserved.
Won that, which was not enough. I wanted Beasts to do well. Well, part of the issue with the Indie Spirits, which have been raised by some of my colleagues at IndieWire, is that it's just too much in bed with Harvey Weinstein. I mean, and what happens is that the committee that nominates and then they get to decide what the cutoff budget is for the films, and if it goes over the limit, you know, they can do that. And they decided that last year that The Artist was eligible, even though it was French,
right?
You know, for an American independent award. And they decided to accept Silver Linings Playbook at $21 million budget. And so it dominated the whole thing and beat out Beasts. What if Beasts had been rewarded at the Indie Spirits? That would have been so great.
Yes, exactly. And I thought, you know, Wes Anderson doesn't win Best Screenplay. Silver Linings Playbook wins Best Feature, Best Director.
Luckily, the Sessions did win for John Hawkes, thank God, who wasn't even nominated for an Oscar. So that was an unusual thing for them because they tend to go with the Oscar nominees.
That's true.
But he also, and they won for Helen Hunt. So I was very pleased about that.
Well, now you mentioned that you really like the musical aspect of the award show last night. And just because I check in on Get Glue, I do all these online check-in things, Foursquare and Get Glue.
I see that you follow me on Get Glue.
Yes. In fact, I followed you when I was watching Smash the other night. I said, oh, Ann Thompson likes this show. I said, I think we're the two people watching it.
Yeah, well, it's dying. It isn't me. It's going to be pulled in no time. It's very expensive, and it's actually produced by the guys who produced the Oscars.
That's right. That
little trivia note. But I am compelled to watch it because I love musicals, even though I cannot stand Deborah Messing and I want her to get off the show.
Well, I think they're kind of headed that way.
It's getting worse. I have to admit, it is.
I am compelled not to watch the Smash because I love musicals.
Well, I know other people feel that way. It's still more of what I like than the actual production numbers are pleasurable for me. And I'm still rooting for the two girls who are the two singers and lead. I mean, but the whole Angelica Houston, and the guy who plays the director is very compelling and I like him. It's the behind the scenes stuff that's working for me. I like it, except that Deborah Messing is very annoying.
But I don't think it's going to, I think it'll last the season, but will not be picked
up. It's dead. There's no question about it.
It could get killed. It could get pulled.
No, it's going to be killed. It's dead.
You think?
It came back far lower ratings than it had before, and the ratings before sucked. The show is dead.
Well,
there's not a chance in hell it's coming back for season three.
Well, NBC itself is hurting.
Indeed.
Absolutely. Yeah. The NBC practically has no shows in the top 40. I mean, it's literally on life support. You know, its only success in the fall were The Voice and NFL football on Sunday nights. Now that those are both on hiatus, it has nothing. Its top-rated show last week was Dateline NBC on Friday night, one of the
That's
lowest
really
nights.
That's really depressing.
Yes, number two was Law & Order SVU, and number three was Chicago Fire. That's as close to a success story as they have. No sitcoms in the top 40. Their highest rated comedy show is the Betty White thing, which they keep double pumping throughout the night. This network is in complete free fall, and Smash is just the latest, you know, problem. It's been a bad season for all the networks, but NBC has gone from first to fourth in the key demos. It was always had a weak schedule, and it's literally collapsed.
Well, and it's now run by, NBC is run by Bob Greenblatt, who of course, used to head Showtime, and he is behind Weeds and Dexter over there at Showtime, and I think he's still going to be given a chance this next season.
Well, I'm not saying he'll be fired today, but I mean, this is when did he join?
I don't know. I guess, Anne, you don't really follow television.
Not the way you do. No.
No. Yeah.
I mean,
no.
I'm more of I'm trying actually to pay more attention to it. I'm tracking HBO and House of Cards, and I watch a lot of the shows as a consumer. And also on the blog, we try to cover more television because that's where the smart movie people are going, you know, from the producers to the talent to the stars. It's just a lot more interesting than the movies are a lot of the time.
Well, everything from Mad Men, The Walking Dead, and now I as everybody knows, I like The Americans and I like Smash. But I agree. I mean, it is it's not going to make it. It's dead. I just if they hadn't shot the entire season already, it probably wouldn't they wouldn't air all the episodes.
Yeah. Well, and they've got nothing to put on instead. What else are you watching, Anne? What else do you enjoy?
I love Downton Abbey. Justified. Oh. Timothy Oliphant is the sexiest man on television. Mm-hmm. I've given up on Walking Dead after I watched right up until this season, and then I just didn't start. I just didn't want to see any more gore, basically. And because they just turned in a real genre direction. I can't wait for Game of Thrones to come back. That to me is heaven on earth. I love girls, and I loved Downton Abbey. You know, you can see I'm spending a lot of time with it. And I like Nashville.
Well, certainly you must be exhausted, not only from talking to us for so long, but again, the Spirit Awards and the Academy Awards in one weekend.
And I haven't filed all my stories yet. But you know what? This is what I do, and I'm happy, and I had a great time last night. I went to the Governor's Ball. I went to the Fox Party. I went to the Oscars. What's not to like? And later this week, I'll hit the spa in Ojai and go into detox mode.
Yeah, maybe you can spend all that money you want on the Oscar ballot.
I don't think I participated in an actual money pool, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
I don't think I even bothered, so I didn't make any money this year.
I didn't know whether the Gold Derby pool was...
I don't think there's any money involved.
Just prestige.
Thanks, guys. This was fun.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Anytime.
Bye.
Well, that was great of Anne to stop by. We sort of segued from the Oscars into television.
Yes, and we already talked about NBC, and not much to talk about there, I suppose.
Well, it's a bad season for everybody. The fall and the spring, it's been a very bad year for all of network television. They really have had trouble to launch any new hits. The closest to a hit is The Following on Fox, but no new sitcoms for anybody have clicked. Very few dramas. People are pointing to very modest success stories as their claim to fame. And NBC is desperately waiting for The Voice to return, but that happens in March. And it has two new judges, so that's very scary. They've messed with the formula. And they're double pumping the show, which is going to wear out its welcome quicker, just like ABC did with how to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. So, you know, they've got one little success story, which is The Voice, and now they're going to drive it into the ground.
Well, and I guess that kind of moves us along into this story about Nielsen and their big changes.
That's right. I mean, maybe the networks are having more success than is being captured by Nielsen. Nielsen finally made a statement. They've got a committee, apparently. It's called the What Nielsen Measures Committee. And it's a committee that helps them decide what to measure. And by measure, we mean how do they track what TV shows people are actually watching?
Can I translate that for our listeners? That committee goes to New York and sits down with the folks on Madison Avenue and says, hey, can we track X? Can we track Y? Would you mind if we tracked Z? And whatever the advertisers feel is necessary to track, that's what they'll track. So they basically it's a go-between between the television networks and the advertisers. It's a middleman.
That doesn't sound quite right, because it sounds to me like the advertisers and the community all have wanted Nielsen to start capturing viewers more in more various ways, and Nielsen has been resistant. Make it sound like the advertisers are the ones dragging their feet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Nielsen didn't have enough of a push to do it. Otherwise, they would have.
Well, there's a lot of ways they're not capturing people. They're not capturing people who stream television. They're not capturing people in dorm rooms and bars. That's been a big problem for years as far as sports programming and a lot of television, like the Oscars. People watch that in groups, and it's very hard to track that, but Nielsen isn't even trying. But now they've announced, okay, there are people who don't have cable in their homes. We're going to catch them when they're watching television shows on Hulu or streaming onto their tablet and things like that. So they've announced that they're going to do that. It's a very small change. It's going to take a while to be incorporated. It's going to have a very modest effect, if anything at all, on the actual ratings of shows. But it's a step towards the future where they try to capture what people are actually watching. Because when you tell me that 8 million people watched the season finale of Downton Abbey, I say no way. Every single person I know from 20 to 80 is watching that show. Everybody.
Really? Everybody?
I know teenage girls who are watching it. I know my middle-aged brother and his wife. I know my 70, 80-plus-year-old mother, and all her friends are watching it.
My sisters
in their 30s. Everybody I know is watching that show.
Well, that's 5-6 people, so we only have 7 million.
I'm saying demographics, demographic-wise. There are shows like Mad Men that get more press than they actually get viewers. And so you don't want to get confused into thinking that just because people write about a show like Girls or Mad Men, that means tens of millions of people are watching it. But Downton Abbey is an absolute phenomenon, and there are tons of people watching it. They seem to come from all sorts of different areas. It's crossed over into sort of soap territory as far as viewership. It's not people who just watch British imports. It seems to me it's got a bigger audience than 8 million viewers.
Well, and now with viewing on tablets and phones and the streaming, you can actually count exactly precisely how many people are watching something. The other day I was in a restaurant and somebody was sitting at the bar watching the television at the bar. The Lakers were on. On their phone, they were also watching another basketball game. And I thought, really? I mean, come on. You really need to second screen it that bad? So, ultimately, what do you think? I mean, can all of these new measurements for that Nielsen has planned, can it save Smash?
Well, Smash was saved because it has really good demographics, meaning the people who watched it were wealthy, made a lot of money, well-educated, and relatively hard to capture. That's why certain shows, going back to like St. Elsewhere, a show with very modest ratings would survive because the people watching the show made a lot of money and were educated and were hard to catch. And therefore, advertisers were happy. Even though it was modest ratings, they really liked the audience that was watching. So that's the savior for Smash. And the more people that are capturing Smash on their tablets and things like that, and where you catch them and see, yes, they are watching it, yes, that absolutely does help a show. This new system is going to track people who watch television via their Xbox or their PlayStation, not just streaming onto, you know, tablets, but streaming to their television via, you know, systems like that. But what we're talking about is a universe of 23,000 TV homes. That's where Nielsen tracks ratings. And that's where I just think, what is going on? Why aren't they partnering with the major cable systems and capturing tens of millions of people? Why are they still trying to use this small sample when you could track what I'm watching on my television and it would just be a crude sample? You wouldn't know who was in the room and how many people were watching, but you would know who's in that home and what's on the television second by second, 24 hours a day. Why they haven't switched to that and used that as a sample rather than, you know, it's the difference between guessing what people are watching and using SoundScan, where you actually measure what people are buying. You know, when you know what they're buying rather than guessing, that's a whole new world.
Yes, I agree. And I think it's definitely headed that way. I think part of it is...
It's not headed that way. They haven't made the slightest attempt to partner with cable systems and say, wait a second, we can measure what everybody's actually watching in 50 million homes in the blink of an eye. Let's get with Time Warner.
Well,
and
that's
Comcast
the thing. It's not. It's
it.
Not the blink of an eye. If it were the blink of an eye... Well,
they've had 30 years. Cable's been around for decades. Don't tell me it's not the blink of an eye. They've got the box here tracking what I watch. They could set it up easily. It would be work, but it's been 30 years. They haven't even begun to try. They're not even in talks to do it.
So what does that tell you, Michael? What does that tell you? If they're not in talks to do it, what does that tell you?
That it's that much farther away from actually happening if it ever does.
Well, it tells you that somebody doesn't want it.
And who doesn't want it?
Well, I think in this case, it is the networks themselves, in part.
What are you talking about? They're losing. They've got viewers watching television that aren't being counted by Nielsen. They're furious. They've been arguing and pushing and kicking Nielsen. Hey, you need to capture people in dorm rooms, in bars. You need to capture all the people who are watching on streaming via Xbox. And, you know, they're watching all our shows and you're not counting them. They're furious. They're losing money.
Well, I think there's also a privacy issue, but...
No, there's no privacy issue. There's not a single bit of privacy issue. Nobody's seeing that they want Time Warner to report to Nielsen what Michael Giltz is watching, but there's not a chance in heck. They already know everything I do in my life online. I wouldn't object in the least to them using, hey, this 46-year-old male is television channel, and what is that 46-year-old male watching, and compiling with a bunch of other people into anonymous statistics. Most people would love to know that the shows they're watching are being tabulated and counted so that the shows they like actually get support and survive.
Kind of like what they do in music.
That's right. Music made a big change when they switched from guessing what people bought to actually counting actual sales at the register. That was a titanic shift in music. It suddenly revealed a lot of people were buying country music and rap and gospel and all these genres that people ignored. And it made a huge change in the industry, turned people like Garth Brooks into superstars. It turned rap into mainstream far more quickly than it might have otherwise. And it was a big, big change in the industry.
Well, now they're going through a change again.
What is it?
At least Billboard is. And they announced this week that they would be adding YouTube views to the mix of stats that they kind of track to determine a song's popularity. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, it immediately sent this song Harlem Shake, which has turned into a meme, which we should probably not discuss right now since we're already running long. But boy, would I love to. It went from like number 15 to number one on the Hot 100 chart.
It was at number 15?
I think so, yes.
I didn't think it was that high up. It was a very poorly selling song. It wasn't selling a lot, but it was getting modest. I thought it was only a video hit. It was ranked number 15.
Actually,
the sales
sum alone would have been good for a number three ranking on the Hot Digital songs.
No, Hot Digital, that's a totally different chart. Don't talk about that. That's different.
Hold on. And it would have placed within...
You're comparing apples versus oranges.
Can I finish?
Where was it ranked the week before on the Hot 100?
And it would have placed within the top 15 on the Hot 100 without the inclusion of YouTube streams in the calculation, according to Billboard.
That's the week that it exploded.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So 2 weeks ago, this song came out in June of last year.
Yeah, in the summer of last year.
And suddenly it exploded on YouTube. 2 weeks ago, it sold 1,000 copies, 1,000 digital downloads. 1 week ago, it sold 18,000 digital downloads. Last week, it sold 262,000 digital downloads. So clearly, it was exploding in popularity. On Airplay, 2 weeks ago, it had two plays in the entire country, meaning nobody, after you know, June of last year, 7-8 months available, it was played twice on any radio station in the entire country, just two times. Last week, it was played on 112 radio stations, just at least once on each of those stations, very modestly. One station played it 25 times in the entire week, which is not a lot. That's three times a day. But that's not even heavy rotation, but that's rotation. And that was last week. This week, of course, it just exploded. So this is a song that went from nowhere to huge success, thanks to YouTube videos where it's had millions of views. And when you combine all those tracks sold and YouTube viewings, it exploded in its number one song in the country.
Well, do you think that there will be artists, and I'm not talking about the Justin Biebers of the world where they're completely amateurs and they kind of rocket to stardom, but artists like you mentioned, Garth Brooks, who before SoundScan may not have been considered a huge seller, but in fact was a huge seller, where once these YouTube views are put in, and all of a sudden maybe you have some indie rock band like Grizzly Bear or the Dirty Projectors, they're actually at number one on the Hot 100.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're asking. Success begets success. When you're factoring in the popularity of YouTube viewings and the song moves up higher on the chart, it has more visibility. And then suddenly people who hadn't heard of Harlem Shake, people who never look at YouTube videos, see a song on the radio, hear a song on the radio, or they see it on the chart, they check it out, and that means it becomes even more popular. So once you get that visibility that the YouTube video viewing gives you, then you reach people who don't look at YouTube videos, and it compounds itself, and suddenly once you're up on the charts and you're on the radio, then if you're a hit, you're going to become an even bigger hit. So Garth Brooks was selling albums, but when it became more visible, when suddenly he was at the top of the Billboard charts, people who hadn't heard of him before saw his name, saw his songs, and suddenly said, oh, I'll check that out. And suddenly he went from maybe selling 2 to 3 million copies to selling 9 or 10 million copies.
Okay, so with that in mind, this is what I'm asking, is that let's take the Dirty Projectors or Grizzly Bear as an example. They might be down around 199 with one of their singles. They might not even chart with one of their singles. However, possibly on YouTube, they're a huge hit only on YouTube. And of course, now they're number within the top 10 because of that.
Right. And then that leads to further success, possibly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anybody, that's like MTV back in the day. If you had a video that was striking and stood out, that would help you stand out, get your video played on MTV, became a hit. Then people on radio played it. It all helps. And it's important to recognize the YouTube video. And that's how a lot of people discover new music. It's not because necessarily the videos are so interesting anymore. It's just that's where they go to listen to new music. Someone says, oh, I've heard this great song. People type in the thing on YouTube. I do it. I type in the thing at YouTube and the song starts playing. I don't even look at the video. It's just a way to access music instantly. You used to go to MySpace. Now you go to YouTube. And once those hits are factored in, once that viewing's factored in, gives you more visibility, that can only help.
Well, and that kind of will speak volumes to streaming services. I've actually seen people put entire YouTube playlists together and they're not watching the videos. They just pump it through their stereo at a party and the videos are playing on a computer somewhere and they're just using it for music.
Exactly. It's a big deal.
Ooh, okay. Well, if that's a big deal, then what about some of these stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Here's our first story. I guess we should probably start with this since it's, kind of nice little transition from film into theater. Broadway used to be scared of movies. They thought if a musical was turned into a film, why would anyone bother to see it? At least see it live. That paper tiger has long been demolished with countless examples, both good and bad, from the awful film version of Rock of Ages, somehow helping the Broadway run, to the Oscar-winning smash hit Chicago, supercharging its Broadway version. Now a movie is inspiring a revival with the smash film Les Miserables, which nobody seemed to mispronounce last night, sending a touring production of the famed blockbuster back to Broadway in March of 2014. This extensively reworked production, unlike the ill-fated revival of 2006 that ran for just over a year, has received good reviews on the road, doing away with the turntable that was so central to the show's look, for example. In this case, the hit film has fueled a new Broadway revival just 5 years after its last run. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop, really, because it was just here a few years ago. The producer, Cameron McIntosh, admits it was a mistake last time. He brought it back too soon. It was just a few years after the original run had closed, and people felt like, didn't it just end? So it's a shame that he had that revival. But he says, you know what? This is new. It's fresh. The movie's on people's minds. That was a mistake, but who knows what'll happen this time. We've got it on the road. It's doing well. Let's take it to Broadway.
Now, I'm going to try and run through some of these Big Deal or Big Whoops. Author and scholar Leslie Klinger is suing the estate of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, he of Sherlock fame. She's suing, attempting to establish one...
I don't know, it's a she.
Ah, you're right.
I believe he's British. I'm not sure about that, but I think for some reason he's British and it's a man. But I don't know. Maybe it's a woman. I apologize.
Leslie Klinger is attempting to establish once and for all that Sherlock Holmes is in the public domain. Klinger is editing a book with Laurie R. King, the author of a best-selling series of novels that feature Holmes and his wife. The estate contacted their publisher and demanded a license fee. If the publishers didn't pay up, they didn't threaten to sue. They threatened to pressure publishers into dropping the book. Klinger says about 10 short stories are still under copyright and about 50 are in the public domain. The legal issues are clear, but the cost of fighting the estate keeps people at bay. And this is a quote, "In practice, major creators such as Warner Brothers and CBS have found it cost-effective to pay a license fee rather than to challenge the estate's position," Klinger told Publishers Weekly. Similarly, our previous publisher, Random House, believed that it was cheaper to pay than to fight. Fighting means legal fees and delays, antithetical to big business. But I believe that it's time that someone takes this case to court. Big Deal or Big Whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I mean, sure, Arthur Conan Doyle died in 1930. That was 83 years ago. It's a little crazy that these aren't in the public domain. What's interesting here is that they basically are in the public domain, but the estate just keeps saying people, hey, you got to give us some money in order to do it. And nobody wants to bother to challenge them. And so they keep getting money, even though it's in the public domain and really is, you know, available. Nobody wants to go to the bother. And now this person who is a lawyer and is able to deal with fighting the case on their own for presumably no money gets to challenge them and finally gets it settled in court.
Well, it'll be interesting because Warner Brothers would stop paying, that's for sure.
Well, they all will, yeah.
Yeah. The hit song Come Sail Away, Styx, one of my favorite bands from the 80s. You know, it might make Styx the better choice, but it's Matchbox 20 that is sailing the high seas. Yes, leaving no stone unturned when it comes to revenue, the rock band has tossed coolness to the wind and is the main attraction for a four-day cruise this December. The cruise goes from Miami to Nassau. The band will perform multiple times in a near 1,000-seat venue and in other locations around the ship. My God, what are they going to busk?
Yeah,
on the Lido deck, as well as they're going to do question and answer sessions, photo opportunities, and evening deck parties where fans and band members can mingle as the fantasy class cruise ship travels the beautiful blue Atlantic, hopefully not hitting an iceberg. Prices range from $700 to $3,000. So is this cruise going to be a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. I'm tending to say it's a little embarrassing, but you know what? We used to think Vegas was embarrassing for acts. Now everybody goes there. And if you just look at album sales, you can see why this is. Matchbox 20, their debut album, 12 million copies. Their second album, 4 million copies. Their third album, 1.4 million copies. Their fourth album, which came out last September, it went to number one, but it hasn't even gone gold yet. So they're not making money on album sales. So they got touring and they got stuff like this.
Yeah, maybe they're getting maybe they're getting all their fans together on this boat.
Yeah, and you know what? It could be fun. You know, I mock it. It seems a little nutty and sad. Something you might do way beyond at the end of your career, and they're not there as such. Rob Thomas is very successful in a lot of ways, but you know, it's a little embarrassing.
Might be a good way to take a free vacation. Who knows?
Exactly.
The Los Angeles Times is reporting that a musical version of the film and play A Bronx Tale is in the works, and Robert De Niro might direct. The Chaz Palminteri piece began as a one-man show and then became De Niro's directorial debut back in 1993. Now, says the LA Times, it might become a musical. So it basically is going to be a musical based on a film, based on a play.
On a play.
Yeah.
Happens all the time.
Music mogul Tommy Mottola is set to produce, and Chaz is working on the book. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big whoop.
Okay.
I don't know why they even wrote this story. It's been kicking around for years. He's talked about this for years. Nothing's happening. There's not a single quote from anybody. There's not a quote from De Niro. There's no composer attached, no songs. They haven't done a reading or a workshop. There's no production announced. De Niro's going to direct a stage musical. Are you kidding me? That's not going to happen. It's just, it's a ridiculous non-story. I don't know why they even filled up space with it.
Well, then we're sorry for taking your time with it.
It's a good thing to know. Look at a story. They don't quote anybody. There's nothing announced. There's no anything. There's no news attached. They're just like, oh, yeah, it'd be nice if it was a musical. That's what this story amounted to. It's not worthy of the LA Times.
In an abrupt decision, actor Shia LaBeouf he's an actor? No way. He has abandoned his plans to make his Broadway debut and exited the revival of Orphans over good old-fashioned creative differences. And usually that means it ain't about creative differences at all.
He punched a wall. I think it might be.
Oh, okay. Well, the decision to leave the show during rehearsals and less than a month before the first preview was so abrupt that they hadn't even changed their website when it was announced. Actor Alec Baldwin and Tom Sturridge, the latter from the movie On the Road, they remain. And actor Ben Foster has been tapped to replace LaBeouf in the show. It was later revealed by LaBeouf himself, who publicized several emails via Twitter, that he was having a spat with one Alec Baldwin.
And everyone else, it seems like.
Yeah, after dissing both the Indiana Jones movie he starred in and losing the Transformers franchise, LaBeouf was determined to remake himself by doing the sexually explicit Lars von Trier movie and this move into live theater. Now he has to hope that porn is the new black. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop for the show because Alec Baldwin was really the draw. Shia LaBeouf was really a curiosity factor and perhaps a train wreck in the making since he doesn't have a lot of stage experience. Not that I wasn't rooting for him. So the show should be fine. It's a shame. It would have been nice to see how he did, but there you go.
You know, a Canadian music festival called the Capital Hoedown was canceled last summer, but not before tens of thousands of tickets were sold. Contracts were signed and deal agreements could leak to the press. Taylor Swift was a headliner, along with Reba McEntire and Sheryl Crow, among many others, for the event, which takes place in Ottawa. Taylor was reportedly paid $2.5 million in appearance fees. Now the promoter says, hey, we want our money back. Here's the deal. Tickets were sold by a ticket agency, and when the concert was canceled in July, fans naturally demanded their money back. Fans asked the credit card company, Evo, for their money. So Evo was doing the merchant sales for this ticket company. Evo asked the ticket selling company, Fire, for the money back. Fire asked Taylor Swift for their money back. And they're all going to court. Swift and the other stars appeared to back out as promoters struggled with the basics like, you know, getting a permit for where the festival would be held. Swift's people say they have no contract or dealings with Fire and that The company should talk to the promoters, which is actually true. Among Swift's contract points, she would do a 75-minute set, have approval over the acts performing ahead of her, would get a police escort. Really? A police escort? What is she, like the president now? Do a meet and greet limited to 30 people, sign 2 guitars, and donate them to local charities. Guarantee Sperling would be blocked from the venue and her people warned immediately if he attempted to gain entry and have 60 hotel rooms for her and her entourage. I think one of those may not be true. Just saying. So is this festival meltdown a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. By the way, the Meltdown Festival is a thing in the UK, which is a great festival. There's a little play on words there. All of the stuff, again, festival doesn't happen. I don't know if she ever got the money and why she wouldn't give it back if she's not able to do the show, but that's a different issue. Why the promoter and the ticket people and the credit card people, they're all suing each other. It's crazy. We're just interested in the contract details, all of which sound basically normal, except for these 60 hotel rooms. That seems like a lot.
That's an entourage.
That's an entourage. But I mean, this police escort to me is very normal. I'm sure she gets weird people and strange things. I think it's perfectly natural she would have a police escort from the airport. I mean, why not?
Well, and the 60 hotel rooms, you know, they're probably not for her entourage. It's probably for production personnel.
It's her people. It's not for other people.
Yeah, but that's probably just part of the, you know, that's a rider. Typical.
But that's
rider,
a lot of people. 60?
It is, but you know, lighting and
I guess
video
touring.
And yeah.
60. Yeah. Oh, well.
You should see Bruce Springsteen has like a whole camp that he brings.
I guess it's true. I just thought for a festival, you wouldn't need as many people because they're not doing everything. It's going to be set up for them. There's going to be one set of crew. Every act's not going to bring in their own lighting people.
No. Not every act is allowed to. Only the headliners.
Okay.
Now, Mike Daisy. Remember him? He is the monologuist who was disgraced when it was revealed he had lied about numerous key factual details in his muckraking show about Apple and its factories in China. He's actually Michael's best friend. Well, Mike Daisy has now investigated himself and decided that, overall, his show was a force for good. According to the LA Times, Daisy was wondering if his play had done more damage than good when it came to Apple's practices and the practices of the companies its subcontracts outwork to, especially, say, Foxconn in China. And he says to the LA Times, I shared the concern that everything I'd done would actually cause more damage than good, but I spent a lot of obsessive time tracking all of it. And it's clear at this point that that's simply not the case at all. And he said that citing reports that pressure from Apple and agitation by Chinese workers has improved their lot. Daisy has also been auditing a class on journalistic ethics at NYU. And when
never too late,
when his iPhone 3GS broke, guess what? He bought the latest iPhone 5. So, you know, the guy who doesn't practice what he preaches. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop? Who better to investigate yourself than a guy disgraced for his fake investigations?
Wow. Couldn't have said it better myself. Well, this next one, what a tragedy this is turning out to be. NBC is so desperate for shows that it was planning to try and somehow relaunch the sitcom Up All Night and switch it from a hip single-camera comedy with some really cool stars to a more conventional multi-camera show. The problem? No one else from the show was actually on board with that idea. First, Christina Applegate said she was leaving the show due to creative differences, which means not creative differences. As in, what's up with all the extra cameras was probably one of those creative differences. Then NBC said, maybe they'd film 3 episodes in the new style. Then Will Arnett got cast in a new sitcom, which would make starring in Up All Night, well, let's just say, you know, a tad tricky. Then NBC said maybe they'd film 1 new episode as sort of a pilot for a potential season 3. Then Maya Rudolph got pregnant. Then NBC said, heck with it. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. If the show is actually any good, maybe more people would care.
Ooh. Google is just like Apple and Facebook. Sort of. Except, well, I guess they do make hardware now. They all want to launch a music streaming service to compete with Spotify and the like, but it's awfully complicated. Google is in talks with big music labels, but those same labels keep complaining that Google hasn't done enough to stop linking to pirate music websites. Google likely plans to make the music streaming service available on all the smartphones and tablets powered by Google's operating system, Android, just as Apple has iTunes on all its products. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop because they haven't move forward. We don't have any deals in place. We don't have anything happening. It's just like a pie in the sky idea. It's Google. If they want to make it happen, I assume they will. But since there's no new information, they're talking to people and there's no breakthrough in what sort of plans they've been able to make. It just sounds like a big whoop to me.
Well, that's actually a good place for us to kind of maybe end Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week, because during Inside Baseball, which is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing, we usually explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I figured it would be good to stop there because we're talking about a streaming service over on Google. And our Inside Baseball story this week is about Spotify, which is going to be asking record labels over the next several weeks. They're renegotiating their licensing fees. They're going to be asking to A, lower costs, and B, they want to open up their service to be free for mobile phones.
Well, they want to make the free version available on mobile devices.
Right, exactly.
Which is something, obviously, that's a big, huge thing. One reason people subscribe and pay up is so they can get access on their mobile phone. So that sort of kills a big incentive to subscribe to them.
That's why I subscribe.
Right. But if you could just get the free version, would that be enough on your mobile phone? Or do you like it enough that you'd want to have the full version?
I'd probably want to have the full version because I wouldn't have to listen to commercials. I'd be able to download instead of just stream. So I could, you know, if I was on an airplane, I could, you know, download the music and play it.
Well, that's exactly what Spotify says will happen. And that's why they want to do it. They feel like they've had their hands tied behind their back. They want to reach a whole new audience. They're just annoyed they have to have this restriction and they got to pay so much money for music. The problem, of course, is that a lot of artists and labels say you're not paying enough money for music.
Right. And here's the thing. You know, I've heard a couple of record company executives that I've spoken to in the past probably month and a half. They've all said, look, we kind of know that at some point we're going to have to lower the licensing fees. We're charging too much. We charged too much out of the gate because we got robbed by Apple the first time. So we didn't want that to happen again, where some company, you know, winds up becoming, you know, billionaires off of our product without us actually receiving anything. But there's no way. Again, it's these big conglomerates forcing the businesses around them to pay so much that there's no way to actually make a profit. There's no way to stay in business. And what the music industry realizes at this point, much like the visual effects people that we were just talking about, they actually need Spotify.
Uh-huh. It's such a huge way to reach people with music.
Right, exactly. They're saying, well, you know, we kind of do need them. We don't want them to go away. They're a behemoth. Granted, they have 5 million paying subscribers out of 20 million total users around the world. But this is kind of the direction the industry is headed in. And if we somehow torpedo this based on our own greed, we could be torpedoing ourselves.
Well, isn't the point that they should be moving forward with Spotify and Apple and Amazon and Google and Facebook and let them all be offering their competing services so that they're not stuck with one monopolistic company like iTunes back in the day? So they've got them all there. And if all five of them are successful, they reach a lot more people and maybe the streaming money will actually add up.
I completely agree. And, you know, those are the alternatives. You just mentioned all of Sony, in fact. And those companies all have very, very deep pockets, and they sell their music at these like really thin margins. Amazon so that they could sell other items, Microsoft so that they could sell hardware, same with Apple, Google so that they could sell search, you know, and so Spotify.
So you don't want your music to become a loss leader, though, for all these companies.
Precisely. Precisely. So that's really, you don't want your product to become a loss leader. That is definitely true. And so that's why they really need Spotify, a company that solely exists for music.
So, but if Spotify is already not paying enough to the royalties, how can they be paying even less? Because you're going to reach that many more people?
Well, what they're basically saying is, hey, you think your music is worth this much, but we can't sell it. So you might think you need a licensing fee this high, but based on what we can earn, guess what? It's not worth that much.
And the studios are starting to come around and believe that.
The record company, well, they've kind of known for some time. They've always tried to figure out a way to replace CD revenue, which, of course, CD revenue is declining, which is far more lucrative than this streaming business. But they're realizing, well, I guess we can't get it all out of services like Spotify. Because it's really beginning to, like, there are businesses that are hurting, businesses that are very close to them, and they actually do rely on. And so they're having to readjust their thinking on what licensing fees are actually worth.
So what's going to happen?
Can I tell you in about 2 months?
Well, can you tell me after it happens?
Sure.
Is that what you're going to do?
Yes, exactly.
Well, you know, they may be missing a lot of sales and a lot of popularity. Just like television, you want to be capturing all the music that's being listened to right now, which is happening on YouTube and on Vimeo and all these other sources. Vivo, I should say. So, you know, tracking what's actually happening and becoming popular is a good way to start. Well, making Spotify not be the only dominant service, but let these other people come in at a royalty rate that works for everybody and can maybe, you know, reach a much bigger audience that will actually pay a little bit every month in order to access it. You know, if it's more popular, more mobile, then people will be ready to pay. What do you pay a month? $10?
Yes, $9.99.
Yeah. And maybe you say, all right, that's one more bill I'm willing to pay.
Yeah. And I haven't bought an album in how long now?
Yeah. See, yeah, that's it.
Yeah. But not because I don't want to, just because I was already, as a human being, buying less albums.
So you're the perfect older adult where, like, you're out of the buying album world, but you're still willing to pay for access to music.
Right. And quite frankly, I should be buying some of these albums. I think the last time I bought an album was in December.
And what was it?
I Love This Giant, the St. Vincent and David Byrne collaboration.
Oh, yeah. Good album. On my best of the year list.
Yes. Well, now I know we are running long. So
okay,
people just stay with us because you're really going to want to hear this email that was sent in to us by a listener to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Now, Michael, do you want to take this? You want me to take it? How do you want to do this? It's kind of an informative, though semi-lengthy email.
I'm happy to read it. I haven't looked at it yet. Hey, kids. Not sure why you insist on being referred to as children or why everyone who writes in has to start their emails by talking about their own salutations, but in an effort not to buck tradition. This, by the way, is from Marshall C., who's based in New York, which actually he says is the current residence of Michael Giltz. Quite true. Hopefully the current and future residents. Anyway, Mark C. says, I want to reference your discussion on Universal Music Publishing Group and the recent deal with Fullscreen and Maker Studios. You talked about it on episode 182 and said that it seems like UMPG was being stupid for signing a contract with companies that made a business out of historically ripping them off. I could see why this might appear to be the case at first, what with the way the deal was covered in media reports. As someone who works in this area for a competitor to UMPG, I wanted to throw in my two cents to try and make this a little more understandable. This arrangement is really a, quote, if you can't beat them, join them sort of deal. There are a multitude of benefits from entering into such agreements. One, they will help Universal Music Publishing Group keep track of the millions of cover videos that get posted to YouTube through these content networks. Two, they will give Universal Music Publishing Group a bigger cut of revenue from cover videos. Three, the MCNs, as they are called, will now be incentivized into promoting the use of the publisher's music in new cover videos. And four, teaming up with the MCNs will make it easier for Universal to collect any back royalties owed. Huh. When you think about it, what UMPG is doing is turning potential enemies into promotional allies, getting a bigger share in the process, all while avoiding steep legal bills from lengthy lawsuits against these same companies. The only media I saw that managed to point all this out was Billboard, a news source you faulted in the past for turning into a place where readers could only find stories about who is dating Justin Bieber. In fairness, they do promote those stories way too much at the detriment of the better work they do, as witnessed here. Here's a link to the story. Love the show. Keep up the good work. And any other obligatory listener email ending. Well, that's usually where you'd say we look great and ask if I've lost weight. Anyway, that comes from Marshall C. in New York. And thanks for your email. Sperling, thoughts?
I when I read this email, I was like, oh, wow, this is an interesting email. And it's a very interesting story on Billboard. Because I knew that there was a reason this was being done. I couldn't obviously convey it properly in last week's show, but I knew, I thought, you know what, Universal Music Publishing Group would not be doing this deal if there wasn't some upside. And sure enough, there's a heck of an upside. And I actually spoke to somebody, because I was trying to figure this out myself, and I spoke to somebody at another publisher who said, look, the problem with these cover videos is there are millions of them, and trying to find them is really, really hard because the algorithms don't always catch them.
It's not worth your time.
Yeah, and it's not always worth our time. And so now, since all these MCNs are...
Which stands for?
Media Content Network.
Okay.
And they are supplying a multitude of these successful cover videos. They're just kind of going to co-opt them.
Well, that makes sense. If you can't beat them, join them. In my world, I see you can make a deal with someone and sue them at the same time. So that's what that would be my first choice. Make a deal with them for the future, but sue them to get the money that ripped you off for in the past. But you're right. If you think they're doing a good service, rather than ignoring what they do, you co-opt them. He makes a very good point, and we appreciate it. As for Billboard, I immediately went to Billboard to look at the story. And again, they've got a new layout on their website, just like they do in the magazine. And the layout on the website is, it's even hard now to find the news stories that they have. And there's a thing that says news, but you actually have to click on Billboard Biz logo in order to get to a better layout that actually shows you new stuff. It's very hard to find news stories now. It's very disappointing. But there you go.
Well, if you want to write to us and tell us, that
the inside dope in your industry.
Yeah. Hey, I'm trying to keep this show under the Oscar telecast. I only have, I still have about 3 hours to go then.
Okay.
Well, if you want to write to us, you can. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher, any podcast aggregator, any way where they give away podcasts for free. You can find our podcast. At least I believe that's true.
Our podcast is sort of a tramp when it comes to giving it away.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but I would recommend that you rate and review the shows in those podcast places and those podcast publishers. I don't know what you call them, podcast aggregators. I'm going to stick with that. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll also find links to Ann Thompson's work, and I'd like to thank her for joining us on today's show.
Congratulations again.
Yeah, Thompson on Hollywood over at the IndieWire website. Also the Oscar Talk podcast. What else can we say? Oh, we have a Twitter account. You can follow us at showbizsandbox is our handle. We also have a Facebook page, which is Showbiz Sandbox on Facebook, so you can like us there. Again, all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a revolving website. This week it is
Emmanuel Riva was robbed.com.
Or if you'd really like to bone up and read some of his work, try michaelgiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.